Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Friday morning. Yes, I said Friday. It's a Friday before holiday weekend, and we are more than a little excited. It is the 4th of September, 13 minutes past 9 o'clock, and do you know where your news stories are? Well, we're going to talk about them in just a second, so get ready. If you would like to chime in and tell us what you think about them, all you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. Let me introduce the panel to you, and we will get started post-haste. Alan Chartok, good morning. How are you, sir?
I'm here post-haste, and it's wonderful to be here on this last day of the week.
Yes.
Going into a long weekend. Wonderful.
Lovely,
wonderful.
Lovely. It's wonderful to have you here. And a good way to start off, we welcome Judith Enck as well, senior fellow, visiting professor at Bennington College, founder of Beyond Plastics, former EPA regional administrator. Good morning, Judith.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
Wonderful to have you with us is what I meant to say. CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Bruschetti, is here. Hello, Heather. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. And today is my youngest son, Dylan's 19th birthday. So it's a big day here in our house.
19. Man, that's great. What a great age. I think so. Yeah, I think so. It seems like I remember 19 as being a good age, but who knows?
He's enjoying it.
Your ages may vary. Jim Ketterer joins us too, Bard Center for Civic Engagement Senior Fellow, Dean of the School of Continuing Education at the American University in Cairo. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. It's a beautiful sunny day in upstate New York. And nice to be back on the roundtable.
Wonderful to have you here as always. All right.
Joe, if I could just say one more thing. I missed my opportunity, but I'm taking Roselle, or she's taking me, to Fire Island to celebrate our 50th birthday on September 6th, which is really a wonderful thing. And we're delighted that we're going to be there, and that'll be fun.
And congratulations. I assume you mean anniversary.
Yeah, did I say birthday?
You said birthday, but which is fine. It's fine. It just
it's
makes your anniversary.
It was the birthday of our marriage.
No, if you want
September 6, 1970. Yeah.
If you want to say birthday, that's fine. It just makes the anniversary story a little creepier then, but that's fine.
you make a very good point.
Well, we congratulate both of you, and that'll be a wonderful way to celebrate on Sunday.
That's great.
Yeah,
50
isn't that
years.
Great?
Congratulations.
Yeah, that's the golden anniversary. Well,
the one who needs the congratulations, as she points out all the time, is Roselle.
No, you're both. Well, you both get wonderful things from the relationship. Yes.
My mom used to call me on my anniversary and say, "Happy anniversary, darling," and they said it wouldn't last. Every year.
Did it
yes.
Put a special song in your heart?
Thanks, Mom.
Yeah.
She meant well. It was her bizarro ank humor.
I remember on my parents' 50th anniversary, my mother said, "Well, why don't we go out?" And we had a big party for them. She said, "Why don't we go out and have a lobster dinner?" And my father said, "Why should we kill a lobster for something that happened 50 years ago?" and that didn't go over well. Well, good morning, everybody. It's wonderful to have you all here. I thank you, panelists, for joining in. So the breaking news overnight was that a suspect in the fatal Portland shooting was killed by officers during an arrest. Law enforcement agents shot and killed an Antifa supporter as they moved to arrest him in Lacey, Washington, according to officials. He was being investigated in last week's killing of a right-wing activist in Portland, Oregon. Michael Forrest Reinol, I believe is how the last name is pronounced, Reinol. It's R-E-I-N-O-E-H-L. And they were trying to arrest him. He was being investigated in that shooting. Initial reports indicated the suspect produced a firearm threatening the lives of law enforcement agents, according to the Marshals Service. Task force members responded to the threat and struck the suspect, who was pronounced dead at the scene. This happening last night. Also, I'm going to kind of put these two stories together, as seven officers were suspended as a black man's suffocation, Royals Rochester, New York. Daniel Prude, who was having a psychotic episode, died after police officers placed a mesh hood over his head. That happened in March as the report took place. Outrage has taken over the city of Rochester as details have emerged this week. So a lot of unrest in this country. And so, Alan, we'll begin with you and then we'll move around the group.
I don't think there's much, Joe, that we haven't all said already. Obviously, this is a time when it cannot be denied that people of color have a much tougher time with the police than Caucasians do. And that is something that is not, that is beyond dispute. Now, when you see something happening in your neighborhood, I've seen it here and other places, and somebody is off the wall and they're yelling and screaming and they're in the street, do you call a social worker? You don't. You call the cops. Now, the question then becomes, do the cops have the right kind of training? And have we recruited the right kind of people to be police officers? And are we asking for the right kind of educational qualifications? Do they have a sociology course? Do they have a social work course? What kind of in-service training do they have? All of that goes to what we are witnessing now.
Jim Ketterer.
I mean, I certainly agree with all of that. And I'm wondering, as we get closer and closer to the election, how any news story about unrest, any news story about violence in Portland and ongoing issues, you know, how does that play as it relates to the presidential campaigns? The Trump campaign is obviously doubling down on the law and order approach, and do any signs of disorder play into the hands of that approach? How is it going to be affected going forward? It seems that the Biden people are trying to come out, and either with his visits to Kenosha or his statements to counter that. But, you know, how is it going to play? How much are we seeing a replay of the 1968 Nixon strategy?
Right. Judith.
Yeah, it's certainly going to be part of President Trump's, quote, law and order theme. And, you know, every day there are tragic situations in this country, sometimes because of the large volume of guns that exist in our society, sometimes because of heavy use of police force. I think the Rochester case is deeply troubling. First, any loss of life, whoever that person is, you know, is sad and disturbing and a loss for the family. This gentleman, Daniel Prude, had mental health issues. There needs to be an investigation here. What I find odd is that this took place 6 months ago.
Right.
And it only became public because the family requested records. In the spring, the medical examiner ruled it a homicide. Just yesterday, the mayor suspended seven police officers. So there are issues of accountability. There are issues, as Alan touched on, the need for police forces to have people who are trained in mental health. But also, was there excessive use of force by seven police officers? My understanding is they covered his face and his mouth because it was early COVID days, and understandably they wanted to protect their own health. But, you know, what other aggressive techniques may have been utilized? So that family deserves a fair and objective investigation. And then commenting on the death of the person in Oregon last night, I just hope that President Trump does not applaud that death.
Right.
And does not use it as, you know, another way to rile up people with his law and order message. I predict that he will, but I sure wish he didn't.
Yeah, because, I mean, obviously he's been painting Antifa as, you know, this as the devil. And so with this person as an Antifa supporter, and then having whatever happened, having the the cops shoot that person, is certainly, I mean, it's troubling because it's another loss of life, obviously. But to see how it is exacerbated, it will be interesting. Heather, anything you'd like to add on this?
Yeah, I mean, I generally agree with what everyone said, and I would really want to emphasize the point that I think we should really be emphasizing and looking very, very hard at what we find as acceptable use of force in the U.S. I mean, I think, you know, whether a person is mentally ill or not, or just acting nuts or resisting or whatever, does it justify an amount of force that results in that person's death? Because I think that is something that hasn't been discussed a lot. And I think we really ought to be looking at that rather than what I see as the broader political discussion, which is, are you with the cops or are you with, you know, the resistors, or are you with the rioters? And that narrative serves only really the president. I don't think that's the right question that we should be asking. And I think I say that in addition to questioning the inherent bias in our criminal justice system that results in, you know, such a disproportionate number of African Americans being taken into custody or being arrested compared to their presence in the general population. So, sorry, long-winded, but I've been thinking about this a lot because I think the mental health issue is one that is going to be used to defend what the officer's actions. But it was ruled a homicide within days of his death, and there was no charges filed. And if they weren't police officers, I don't think that would be the case.
One other thing, just in about the Portland shooting that I wanted to add that I was that I meant to mention but did not. Earlier in the day, the publication Vice published an interview with Reinhold, the man, 48 years old, who was shot and killed last night. They published an interview with Reinhold in which he appeared to admit to the shooting that took place on August 29th, claiming that he acted in self-defense. So just one part of that story that I think is important to point out.
Joe, I'd just like to point out that I think our town of Great Barrington here has a trained social worker who goes on some of the more obvious cases. So, but that isn't enough because, you know, officers really need to know what they're doing.
Absolutely.
Could I also, Jim, mention that I think there's two other elements to this Rochester story that are important to keep an eye on as they relate to broader issues about reform of these uses of force and police issues in general. One is the role of police unions. And I believe that the union in Rochester has come out and said that this is indeed concerning. So their knee-jerk reaction was not to find a way to defend these actions, but to say they're concerning and there needs to be an investigation. And the other is something that Heather was mentioning, and others too, and that this has taken so long for something to happen, that it was ruled a homicide and yet no actions were taken. And I think this relationship between district attorneys and the police is another area that really has to be seriously explored and reformed. That we see time and again, district attorneys, because of their working relationship with the police, apparently unwilling to apply the same law enforcement standards that they would to other citizens.
Which is why, by the way, in New York State, the governor has given over to the attorney general the ultimate responsibility of checking in on that stuff.
Which makes sense, but isn't it reported that the attorney general was given this case in April, and we're just hearing about it this week?
You're making a point.
Yeah.
Well, you make a point.
It's as the Times says, hard not to wonder whether Daniel Prude would still be alive if his brother had been able to call medical professionals instead of the police. When you look at these stories, and I'm interested in the minute or so before we have to go over to news, is just this overall unrest. I mean, Judith, you touched on this, but this is going to be. It just seems, if it is exacerbated, even if it isn't, by the president, this is going to be going back and forth, and it seems like this is going to be the order of the day for the next 2 months.
Yeah, and I think as long as the presidential campaign is focused on, quote, law and order, it's not the right focus for the Democratic candidate. It needs to come back to COVID. It needs to come back to the Trump administration trying to get rid of pre-existing conditions for healthcare. I'm not at all suggesting that instances of tragic deaths at the hand of police should not be examined and should not be addressed, particularly in local communities where it happened. But when law and order is the focus of the presidential race, then Biden is losing. I mean, just yesterday, Trump was in Southwest Pennsylvania talking to a crowd because he just can't, you know, it's oxygen for him. He can't exist without talking to a crowd. I think this was in an airport hangar.
Yeah, Latrobe, Pennsylvania.
Right. And he said he's going to protect jobs from leaving America and then bring, quote, rioters, looters, violent extremists, and anarchists to justice. We're going to hear that sentence from him over and over. The good thing is I don't think it's moving suburban voters, but it's definitely bringing attention to issues that are not COVID, or not how do you get your kids back to school safely, or not healthcare, or not climate change. That dynamic helps Trump and hurts Biden.
We have some letters, and we certainly welcome yours. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We have many more stories to discuss as well. We will do all of that with our panel when we return. Alan Chartok, Judith Enck, Heather Bruschetti, and Jim Ketterer making up the panel this morning. Again, we welcome your thoughts and weighing in on the issues that we're discussing. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Judith Enck, Heather Bruschetti, and Jim Ketterer making up our panel this morning. Welcoming your letters, panel@WAMC.org. From the Washington Post, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden thrust his campaign into the roiling national debate over police violence and racial justice on Thursday as he traveled to Kenosha, Wisconsin, and pointedly embraced the nation's racial reckoning, vowing improvements if elected president. During an emotional meeting held in a church not far from looted downtown buildings, Biden made some of his most direct comments yet on the subject of race, growing introspective at times and speaking barely above a whisper. He said the shock over the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis in May and the shooting that paralyzed Jacob Blake in Kenosha on August 23rd has provided the first window in generations for the nation to address centuries-old problems. Quote, we're finally now getting to the point where we're going to address the original sin in this country, slavery, and all the vestiges of it, Biden said. I can't guarantee you everything gets solved in 4 years, but I can guarantee you one thing. It will be a whole heck of a lot better. We'll move a lot further down the road. In tone and dialogue, Biden's trip differed dramatically from that of President Trump 2 days earlier. The former vice president met with Blake's family and spoke with Blake by phone for 15 minutes before meeting with a disparate group of community leaders. Trump has toured buildings burned after protests after the shooting, and his audience was heavy with members of law enforcement. So what a good day for Joe Biden yesterday, Alan, as far as making his points.
Well, I listened to him. And I do know that he was trying to contrast himself with the president by being very, very quiet. I thought too quiet. I think, you know, there's a certain firmness that is needed here. I may be wrong. I admit that it is a tactic, and clearly, or if it's not a tactic, it's what he really wants to be seen as being considered and saying, I may not be able to, he said, I may not be able to solve all the problems in the next 4 years. That's very different from Trump, who's saying, I'm the only one who can solve all the problems. Problems, parenthesis from Alan, that I've made myself, but nevertheless, problems. So I think there has to be a sort of equilibrium established here in Biden's mind so that he can assure people that he's got the stuff to do it and that he has the moxie to do it, but at the same time to distinguish himself from the bravado and, you know, basically stupidity of Trump.
Judith.
Well, I think Vice President Biden definitely struck the right tone, and I think he was trying to help a community heal and give comfort to the family. And that's what normal presidents do. I do have some concern that he followed Trump to Kenosha. And I hope that's not the pattern for the campaign in the future, where the president goes somewhere, always says outrageous and difficult things, and then I don't want Biden following 2 days later. I think Biden has to stay definitely focused on racial justice and excessive use of force by police and the systemic racism and the systemic challenges, as Jim discussed, in the criminal justice system, where you are expecting DAs to enforce the law against the police when there's an inherent conflict of interest there. I mean, Biden should talk about that, but he really should be emphasizing COVID and healthcare and climate change and so many other issues that I think a lot of Americans want to hear about. And again, not to diminish the pain and the violence in Kenosha, but he can't spend the next 2 months trailing Trump to cities trying to clean up the mess after Trump was there.
I agree with you entirely, but it does show a contrast, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Jim.
Yeah, I think that it was important. I agree with Alan's idea that that Biden needs to be very clear and maybe not too soft-spoken. He needs to be firm on this. And some of it just in the sheer politics of it and his own record. You know, Kamala Harris herself called out Biden for his him being against busing in his early days in the Senate. And Biden, as a supporter, in fact, one of the major supporters of the crime bill, which people see as, you know, part and parcel of mass incarceration. So I think he needs to be clear where he stands now. He needs to be strong and confident. And, you know, it's not just of the moment, but it is also part of his long and complicated own history as a politician who's been around for a very long time.
Heather.
I mean, I think it was a fail personally, for a number of reasons, but partially because of what Alan said earlier, which is he went in there. It obviously it's following the president. There's politics involved. Everything is political in election year. But then his message is sort of mushy. He's kind of not defining what he's going to do about it. And I think that he could easily be called out on, like, this is the first opportunity in generations for us to do something about it. I think anyone, you know, who's been around and paid attention to these issues knows there's been multiple opportunities and there's been a failure to act. So, you know, as far as where he stands on the messages, it was soft. And even when he had this meeting, part of the conversation with people who were upset about the destruction of property there in the city, and you know, he really didn't be very clear about that, other than saying, well, it's wrong, and you know, I know that Black Lives Matter has lost some support, but it's still 50%. It's just not strong messaging. I don't think he helped himself at all.
So, who did I forget? I got everybody, right? When you look at this, when you look at this as far as this goes on, as Judas says, you know, this is just going to be keep on going on. I wonder the idea of how Biden is going to differentiate himself when the president does seem to take all the oxygen out of a room. I understand the sentiment by all of you. I just don't know how he does that.
Well, Joe, if I could.
He should use his running mate.
Yeah, Alan?
Well, he could do that. But, of course, if she comes out guns blazing, it's going to make him look even more, for want of a better word, insipid. Mm. I don't think he was insipid. I don't. I think, you know, his problem is a matter of how he balances himself. I am quite sure, looking at him, he decided he was going to go in there and present this contrast of himself to Trump. But he overdid it, in my mind. I think he has to show that he'll be a firm president. That's what we want. You look at a guy like Harry Truman, you know, what was it about him that people liked before they didn't like? And that was his assertiveness. And I think, you know, Trump is too assertive. Well, it's crazy assertive.
Mm.
But I do think my co-panelists have made it clear that it's possible to do both, to be both good about what you're saying and have a message that's important without giving up everything.
Let's go to some of the letters that we have been getting on these issues. Mary Lou says, our quiet community woke up to a message of hate yesterday morning. Racial epithet was spray painted across the front of a local home and business that displayed a Black Lives Matter poster. We are all shaken to our core. However, as a community, we trust and appreciate our police, who responded immediately after being called. We trust them to investigate this deplorable act and help resolve it. However, I think our community has been changed. If it has been awakened, then that is a good thing. I can only hope. We go to this letter from Roseanne. I watched the whole talk with Biden in the community. His tone was perfect for the setting, a church and hurting citizens. He was there to soothe the community, not cause outrage. Biden was honest about not being able to solve everything in 4 years, unlike the constant lies by the president. Both my husband and myself thought Biden got his point across. We go to Frank, who says, I'm proud to live in Ulster County, where we have a mobile mental health unit team who respond to incidents involving disturbed individuals. Thank you, Ulster County Sheriff, State Police, and local police agencies for cooperating and supporting the mobile team. On a similar subject, we go to Paul. Thank you, Alan, for your succinct and complete summary of what needs to happen with police departments nationwide. Also, the tragic event in Rochester and many others would never have happened if we had Medicare for All, so that mental illness could be diagnosed and treated early. On the subject of police violence, Darby writes, I've worked in the mental health field and received mental health services for decades and feel strongly that police are not the appropriate first responders to people in emotional distress or experiencing crises. The system needs to be reconfigured so that responsibility for health and human services is taken away from police. Communities need non-coercive, supportive services that can respond compassionately to people in crisis.
And I think a lot of police officers would support that. And that would be a productive thing for police unions to negotiate as part of their labor agreements, as opposed to, you know, what we've seen from, for instance, the New York City head of the PPA, which is not helping things.
Heather?
Can I just jump in?
Of
I
course.
I just want to jump in with something, because I think it's important to note that he had been treated that day at Strong Medical Hospital and released from the hospital. So he, for a mental health evaluation, Daniel Prude, I'm talking about. And to me, it highlights the point that even with the mental health intervention, which he did have one earlier in the day, you know, an assessment was made, and probably, you know, I don't want to armchair quarterback that he was not at that time a threat to himself or others. So they released him from the hospital. And then later he had an additional breakdown that resulted in the police intervention. I really do think that, that what that points to is, yes, mental health training and services are very important, but we also need to be looking very hard at what we deem as appropriate force. Because, you know, I have watched parts of the video, and it's not easy to watch. It's just as amazing to me that it's okay to use that much force in an arrest. And that's what's highlighted in the George Floyd homicide also. So I think that's something that hasn't been highlighted, is that he was previously, you know, there was an intervention that same day.
Let's take go ahead.
Oh, okay. I'm so sorry. Go ahead, Joe.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I like to put myself in other people's places. And one of the places I'd put myself in right now is a police officer listening to this discussion, right? Police department gets a call, said, man with a gun, firing the gun. Are you going to say, you know who you would call? Most people know who they would call. They would not call a social worker. They would call the police department. Now, I think the point has been made here and made well today that the police department should have the resources right there and then to be able to talk somebody like that down, to have a qualified social worker who might go out with a team. Nevertheless, in the first instance, that cop who was listening to this discussion right now is saying, yeah, sure, but we're getting a telephone call saying a man's firing a gun.
Mm.
Well, I think the letter writer from Ulster County said they have a mobile unit that needs to get to the scene quickly, and every community needs that.
Heather?
That's true, but Ulster County is a big county, and you got one team, right?
I think in this instance, there was some discussion that, the family wished they had called a mental health professional. I guess the point I wanted to make was they already had done that. They had, he had already been evaluated. And now he's out on the street acting, crazy for lack of a better word. And I don't know that having a mental health professional at the scene at that point would have been their first thought, because they've already tried that. And I agree with you, Alan. I mean, someone has a gun and is waving it around. Public safety, the police ought to have all the authority they need to resolve that situation. I guess my concern is about the degree of restraint that's being used, with a person who, in this instance, is completely naked, and in the beginning is completely compliant, face down on the ground, hands behind his back. It's just, to me, it raises some issues as to the necessity for the amount of force that was used.
And how much education, education those the police officers actually have. I mean, there are many police forces in which the requirements to be a police officer are not what they ought to be. It's that simple.
We have a lot of letters on this, and I want to get to those. Let's take a break, and we'll continue our conversation on the other side. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We welcome your letters. We get letters like this from Laura, who says, can you imagine if teachers entered the classroom wearing riot gear and armed? What a message that would send. Anything that happens out in the world happens in our classrooms. I have 14-year-old girls calling me really bad names, big boys, angry, trying to get in my space, mental illness, racism, drugs. As a teacher, I had to learn to forge relationships and to de-escalate. I actually kept a list of de-escalation techniques on my desk as a reminder, so I would be rational and not get angry. Even if one person is angry or disrespectful, if the police officer or teacher stays respectful, things can be better. Teachers have to handle a lot of dicey situations with only our wits and compassion as our weapons. That from a teacher's perspective on police violence.
Well, and a teacher's perspective on teachers. Teachers have the hardest job in the world under certain circumstances. There's nothing that drives me crazier, for want of a better word, as we have just heard, than the idea that somehow people, teachers teach, from 9 to 3 and then go home. And it makes me nuts, because the fact of the matter is These are the first line of defense for so many of us, and it is, I can't say enough about what they do.
Bob says Trump has already politicized the Portland counter-protester's death. On Thursday, he claimed that the victim was completely innocent, even though there were reports that he was brandishing a knife when he was shot. We go to Deanne, who says the same thing happened when Hillary was running negative comments when she wasn't perfect. Please don't put Biden down so much because you influence people. And when they hear that, they don't want to get out and vote. We go to Julie.
Wait. That's not fair. I'm sorry. This panel is not here to be on, just be a cheering squad for Joe Biden. I, as you probably know, was extremely supportive of his candidacy, and I meant to be. Nevertheless, if he needs some direction, and I think he did in this case, I think it's our duty to say it. So this business about please don't ever say anything that is smacks of negativity about Biden or anybody else is just wrong, in my opinion. I'm not taking it.
Let's go to Julie, who says, a few years ago, my brother-in-law had a manic break. He, too, had been evaluated by a hospital and released. Eventually, things got so bad that our only hope was to have him arrested. There was no other way we could keep him safe from himself. It was heartbreaking. Absolutely. Very sad stories. Let's see. We have about 5 minutes, 6 minutes before we go back. President Trump is denying a report in The Atlantic magazine that he canceled the visit to a U.S. military cemetery outside of Paris in 2018 because he said it was filled with losers. The article walks through several moments where the unnamed sources say the president criticized or blamed soldiers who died in war or questioned why anyone would fight in one. The president says this never happened. Alan, is this a story?
It's a huge story, to be honest with you. This is a president who we know had bone spurs, or alleged bone spurs, and didn't go in the army. He criticized others, John McCain among the most famous of those groups, because they had been taken prisoner. McCain, of course, was a hero. He wouldn't leave until his colleagues left. It is just off the wall. So it is a story because it's outrageous, and this is just one more outrageous act by an outrageous president.
And I ask if it's a story because it's unnamed sources. It happened a long time ago. It's being brought out in the election. Judith, you're...
Yeah, not that long ago. I mean, and it's part of a pattern of comments that he's made about the military. Certainly, we all know John McCain's relationship with Trump, and Trump said some terrible things after McCain died. Mm. The accusations in the Atlantic article was then backed up by an AP reporter who is deeply sourced with military contacts that he got confirmation, and he spoke out that this indeed were comments and situations in France that were made. And I mean, it's the comments are shocking, but not surprising.
No,
I think what's really needed here is John Kelly, who served as the beleaguered chief of staff. He needs to make a public statement, and other military officials. It's hard when you're currently in the military. I don't think they're going to speak out publicly, but if you're out, and for instance, with John Kelly, there's a description that he was standing at his own son's grave in Arlington, and Trump said, "I don't get it. What do they get out of this?" I mean, Kelly needs to speak up and confirm whether this is accurate or not. And that's just one of the many really outrageous descriptions in the Atlantic story.
There is also...
Who the heck is Trump to talk about anybody else being a coward? It's just beyond belief.
In a separate conversation on the trip to Paris, Trump referred to the more than 1,800 Marines who lost their lives as suckers for getting killed. One of the other fairly outrageous statements as part of that article. Jim.
Joe, if I could. Yeah, and I think also in that article, when he was talking about having this grand military parade that he wanted, he said that he did not want any service people who had been wounded in combat because nobody wants to see that. Yeah, it's one outrage after another. He's denying all of this. But to Judith's point about, you know, the generals who Trump initially surrounded himself with, you know, I think people have been waiting for years for them to be the adults in the room. And we've heard a little bit from General Mattis when he did come out and write an op-ed. But in general, they, so to speak, they have not come out. And I think that even if they were to, I'm not sure how much it really moves the political dial for Trump's unmoving base. It is a big story today. It's certainly all over the place, and it's all over social media. But will it be overtaken by the next crisis and outrage of the moment by the time the day is over?
Yeah, well, let me react to that. You know, there are reasons to do things from a political perspective, but there's a better reason to do things, and it's because it's right. And if your kid has been killed or wounded and gotten a Purple Heart, and this guy who had bone spurs allegedly is calling them out, it sounds to me an awful lot like the Japanese during the Second World War. You'll remember that it was a great shame to be alive, and it was a great shame to have been killed, and it was a great shame to have been wounded. So this is a page out of their book, and who is this guy to be saying this? And you know one thing, and that is because he was because this is such a monumental story, and it really is, he got off that plane and he ran to the reporters to deny that he had ever said it. One more lie in a pantheon of lies.
Right, but, yeah, but I agree with all of that.
Worked for him.
But the generals are not going to come to the fore and clarify this. They're not going to be the ones who really make a difference on this. They have had so many opportunities up to this point.
Yeah,
years,
it's true,
of them. Yeah, and they haven't done it.
But they've been trained. They've been trained that the military doesn't subsume the political. I'm sorry, Judith. Go ahead.
No, it's Heather. But go ahead.
No, Heather, it's Heather. And I was just going to say, I actually don't. I think this is going to be a one day story. I mean, I think this is. This bell's already been rung. Everybody already knows based on his comments about McCain. And so it rings so true because we've heard him say things like this before. That being said, I don't think it surprises anyone. And I think he's proven over and over again that these kinds of things, you know, that we all find so offensive and shocking, they don't stick. They don't have any impact on his campaign and on his, you know, his supportive base. So I read it and I was like, yeah, he probably said that. And I totally believe it. You know,
right.
Well, you may be right. You may be right. But I say really quickly that so. If the Democrats have a brain in their head, they are not going to let this one die because it is so important to
them. It'll be in every commercial. I mean, they're going to have commercials based on this.
And Trump is behind. There was a poll in the Military Times last week. Trump is behind Biden by 10 points among enrolled military members.
Which is interesting, too. All right, let's take a break.
In the Military Times, we see that the administration is trying to end funding for Stars and Stripes, which has been around as military reporting since the Civil War.
The enemy of the people, the press.
All right, let's take a break. We will do that, and when we come back, we will continue our conversation. Much more to discuss. We welcome your input. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back with more after news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. It's Friday, everybody. It is a holiday weekend, and we are very excited. I know everyone in this room is very excited, and we welcome you to join us as we discuss all of the horrible stuff that's going on. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org, just trying to balance the two. Alan Chartok, Judith Enck, Heather Bruschetti, and Jim Ketterer joining us this morning, and we welcome your thoughts as always. Let me just get to a couple of the letters, and then we'll move on to some other things. George writes, white people with guns are captured alive all the time. But I can, so just saying that there is a gun present does not explain the level of violence in the arrest. Black people follow police directives and get shot. They run and get shot. They lie on the ground and get shot. That from George. Edward writes, Trump also disrespected the Khan family. That's right. Keyser Khan, of course, who spoke at the Democratic National Convention with his copy of the Constitution in his pocket. We go to Rob, who says, I'm wondering, why do police have to resort to bullets in a volatile situation like this? Couldn't there be one officer have a dart gun with a sedative? Question mark. Sheila writes, having performed on the Miss America USO tour in 1968, visiting the wounded in hospitals, I had firsthand experience with the sacrifice that is made by our servicemen and women. POTUS makes my blood curdle when I think of the horrific blatant comments that he has made about the military, including those made about John McCain. It is time for General Kelly and others in the military to speak up. As Judith had mentioned earlier, Matt said, I won't say I told you so, but I told you so. As a veteran, I was appalled by Trump's statements about McCain early on in his candidacy. It was then that I decided that this was not the type of person who could or should be president. I know his type. Rich boy who evaded the draft and who looks down on those who serve. So are we surprised by his recent blasphemies against war heroes? I hope that my fellow veterans finally see the light about this hypocrite. All right. Those are the letters that I have on those particular subjects, at least for the moment. We go to the president's remarks that he made earlier this week about voting twice. Election officials are reminding people that that is a crime. it is a felony, and you can't make it up. A chorus of election officials, legal analysts, and social media companies on Thursday rushed to condemn and counter President Trump's suggestion this week that his supporters attempt to vote more than once, warning that doing so could constitute a crime and expressing fear that he was undermining the election system. The pushback included pointed statements from an array of federal and local officials, as well as direction action from Facebook and Twitter to attempt to limit the spread of the president's misinformation. Trump had urged supporters during an official White House event in North Carolina on Wednesday to send in a ballot through the mail and then attempt to cast another one at the polling sites in election in an effort to, quote, test the system. He has stated repeatedly that universal mail-in voting would lead to rampant fraud, despite evidence to the contrary. Karen Brinson Bell, executive director of the North Carolina State Board of Elections, issued a lengthy statement emphasizing that attempting to cast multiple ballots would constitute a Class 1 felony, that soliciting someone to vote twice is also a crime. Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel and Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, both Democrats, vowed to prosecute those caught trying to vote more than once. It is illegal in all 50 states and under federal law to vote twice, said Ellen Weintraub, a commissioner with the Federal Elections Commission. As any federal officeholder or law enforcement official should know, and there's still no basis for the conspiracy theory that, quote, vote by mail will lead to a rigged election. That from reporting by the Washington Post. Alan.
There are many people who change their minds, who voted by mail and who want to go and vote. And there's some misinformation floating out there that that's okay and that you can do that. You wouldn't have enough jail cells to put everybody in jail for this. Nevertheless, when a president of the United States, knowing full well that it's wrong, says to do it, it's one more thing, and you clap yourself on the side of your head and you say, what the hell is he trying to do here? What is it that he's trying to do except to put the entire voting system into disrepute? He is a guy. Yes, I'm sure. Go ahead, please.
I was just going to say, but in New York, it is perfectly legal to change your mind. If you do an absentee ballot and you send it in and you change your mind, you can go into the voting booth, you can cast your vote, and it negates your absentee vote. So you didn't vote twice, but it's the vote that you cast in the voting booth is the one that counts.
But that's allowed
in New York.
Yes, but that's not what Trump is talking about. Trump is not talking about, you know, people who are not sure if their absentee ballot arrived on time. I mean, Heather's absolutely right in terms of election law in New York. But what Trump is talking about is getting his supporters to try to really gum up election day and voting. You know, federal law clearly prohibits voting twice in the same election. And Bill Barr is on national TV, the attorney general, backing up Trump's claim, and in fact, spinning out this crazy story that a man collected 1,700 ballots and filled them out, and prosecutors are saying, no, that's not what this case was about at all. And there was no such indictment. So after Barr said this, Department of Justice had to walk back the attorney general's statements. And you probably saw Barr's interview on CNN, where he could not confirm whether federal law prohibits voting twice in the same election. So I think this is pretty serious. I think, you know, Trump is trying to destroy the post office so people are not voting by mail in a timely fashion. And I think it's very clear he's going to try to get his supporters out there gumming up the works. And guess what? It might work because we have a pretty, you know, it's not like the state board of elections and the local boards of elections are using the latest technology and have the capability to deal with attempts to sabotage voting.
Jim?
Yeah, you know, I've worked on elections here, and I've worked on them around the world. And this is a classic case of trying to create the sort of chaos, and as Judith said, gumming up the works to then later declare that there's chaos and call into question the legitimacy of the outcome. This is, you know, if you look around the world, you can see that there's a wide variety of authoritarian leaders who use this when they finally are pressed to hold elections. So none of this is a surprise. No one should be shocked that he's saying this. He's been telegraphing that he's going to try to undermine the legitimacy of the vote since he won in 2016, and he called that rigged. You know, I think that it's almost inevitable that immediately after Election Day, we're going to see a tremendous amount of chaos, much of which is created by those who won't be able to abide by the outcome if Trump loses.
Heather, is there anything else you want to say about that?
I do think I think Judith is 100% right that the technology that many state boards of elections and the locals have is inadequate. I think, you know, in an ideal world, every voter gets the one barcode, and once that barcode has been associated with a vote, there should be no additional votes. It is certainly playing into chaos, and there's, you know, this all these urban legends about people collecting absentee ballots and then, you know, throwing them out or so that the votes don't count. And I think for folks who are on the older side, they may have memories of the legends of those shenanigans, and this kind of sounds like a solution to them. But we should be clear that while it is legal in New York, I don't know that it's legal in other states anyway. So I don't want anyone to think that I'm suggesting that this is what you should do. I agree generally that this is an attempt to inject a little bit more chaos and question into the legitimacy of what ends up being the final tallied result, if we ever can get to a final tallied result, which I think we will, but it's not going to be on Election Day, that's for sure.
Alan?
Well, there's not much more to say. I mean, it is so clear that he's behind in every poll, virtually every poll. And he is desperately, the Times had an article about how wacko he was acting. They didn't use that word, but wacko he was acting on the front page yesterday. And he's desperately trying to figure out the magic bullet which will get him there. And one of those magic bullets, as he sees it, is to say that the elections, as he did in the first election, are corrupt.
Let's go to another story, and interested in, well, everyone's thoughts on this, but I'll probably go to Jim first because of this being his area. But allies and former U.S. officials fear that Trump could seek NATO exit in a second term. President Trump is said to have spoken privately for years about withdrawing from the alliance, a move that critics say would be a major victory for Russia. This is an article in this morning's New York Times. For nearly 4 years, President Trump has publicly railed against the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, angrily demanding that its members pay more for Europe's collective defense. In private, Mr. Trump has gone further, speaking repeatedly about withdrawing altogether from the 71-year-old military alliance, according to those familiar with the conversations. In a second term, he may get his chance. Recent accounts by former senior national security officials in the Trump administration have contributed to growing unease on Capitol Hill and across Europe. They lend credence to a scenario in which Mr. Trump, emboldened by re-election and potentially surrounded by an inexperienced second-term national security team, could finally move to undermine or even end the U.S.'s NATO membership. Jim, as I said, let's go ahead, Alan.
Let's remember who Trump's pal is here, and that's Putin. So what's Putin's number one agenda item? Getting rid of NATO. Always has been. NATO was formed to deal with the Russians. That's what one of the major reasons we have it today. And so the whole idea is to get rid of it. And here's Trump basically taking that side. One more piece of proof that whatever they've got on the guy or whatever that relationship is based on, it's working. It's incredible.
Jim.
Well, you know, the most successful military alliance probably in the history of alliances. Started in 1949, and it's got 30 member states, and it is at the centerpiece of the American relationship with Europe. And so undermining it, doing away with it, would definitely cause great concern to, you know, people who have made their careers out of working in national security. That having been said, you know, there are issues that have been with NATO and with the American relationship with NATO that have been on the boil for a long time, and many presidential administrations haven't really addressed them in the conceptual way that they should. Now, the process by which Trump goes about these things is so scattershot and so unpredictable and oftentimes just kind of crazy that it's hard to make any real sense of it. But Alan's quite right that NATO was started to deter and contain, literally to contain, the Soviet Union. When the Soviet Union ended, NATO did not end. And so what is its reason for being post-Cold War? And it is an alliance that has been kind of in search of a mission. We've seen it involved in Afghanistan, in Libya, in the Balkan Wars, particularly the Kosovo engagement. But that's not really what it was designed to do. The question of, you know, payments, this is something that all American presidents complain about all the time. Trump complains about it in a very Trumpian sort of way. Obama did seal an agreement with NATO countries in the past, and some have abided by it and some have not. So, you know, I think kind of in the way that Trump does in many cases, he is, maybe even by accident, onto some things that are actually important. And I think it would be good for people to ask Joe Biden what he thinks about the future of NATO, and also ask all their members of Congress, either incumbents or challengers, what do they think about it? What is Congress's view of this? I mean, when the Cold War ended, there was a decision made to expand NATO membership and go right up to the Russian border. And even people like George Kennan, who was the author of the containment policy, said that might well be a mistake, and that might make Russia more of an enemy than it would have been otherwise in those initial post-Cold War days. There's a lot of issues swirling around this that are serious and at the kind of the center of American national security, and they need to be addressed, but they need to be addressed in a serious and thoughtful way, not just this kind of scattershot approach that Trump tends to take with everything.
Well, everything you say makes great sense, really is profound. However, I want to point out one thing that just sticks in my craw, and that's that then Colonel Putin, now President for Life Putin, is a sort of transition from the old Soviet Union to the new Russia, both of which have authoritarian tendencies to them. And I think, I don't know whether it's in contradistinction to what you were saying, maybe a little bit misplaced in terms of the separation between the old and the new. What do you think, Jim?
Well, yeah, I mean, the authoritarian nature of the Russian regime, for sure. I mean, but NATO was really not set up to deal with the internal politics of Russia or any other country that they're dealing with. It really was set up as a deterrence. So it was never in the business of trying to reform the way that the Soviet Union acted internally. It was in the business of stopping the Soviet Union from threatening Western Europe. Has it changed its mission? I mean, there is a NATO member now, a longstanding NATO member, Turkey, that is becoming increasingly authoritarian by many people's estimations, who know a lot more about Turkey than I do. They are a NATO member, and in fact, they are dealing with Russia. There are so many issues beneath the surface of this NATO relationship that are so overdue for being addressed, and they haven't been, certainly in the last 3.5 years.
Alan?
Well, nevertheless, you can say that the Russians, are not the threat to the United States that the Soviets were, and you may be right. On the other hand, nobody can say that the Russians haven't been interfering in our elections and haven't been aggressors in places like Ukraine and other places. So I think it's a little premature to count them out as an enemy.
No, Alan, I completely agree. And that gets to my point, which is, okay, I agree with that. Then what is the NATO role in addressing those sorts of issues? I mean, I'll give you another example that that is something to be sorted out. So at the core of NATO is what's known as Article 5 of the NATO Charter that says all for one and one for all. If anybody is attacked, all the rest of the alliance will come to the defense of those who are attacked. The only time it's been instituted is in our defense after 9/11. But I met with some people from the Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, in 2014 when I was in Ukraine for the elections. And they said to me, just casually over, these were government officials, they said, do you really think the United States would go to war with nuclear Russia to defend Estonia or Latvia or Lithuania? Would they really do it or not? And it was certainly a question mark in their minds. And without that, NATO really is adrift. I'm not.
What was your answer?
My answer is that's a longstanding policy. It's at the core of the alliance, and yes, that the United States would do that. Donald Trump himself has failed, after being questioned many, many times, to say whether he supports Article 5, this defense component, or not. He just won't answer it. That is.
I wonder
really
why.
Yeah. Judith, you want in on this?
Well, I certainly have nothing more to add than Jim's excellent analysis here. I do want to point out that this is part of Trump's pattern of not cooperating on the international stage and wanting to go it alone. He appointed John Bolton to the United Nations ambassador position, where, Bolton went in like a wrecking ball. Most recently, The Trump administration said they will not cooperate with the World Health Organization in international efforts to coordinate on bringing a reliable, safe vaccine to the market. So there are real-time consequences for this isolationism. And I think we can all guess why the president does not want to cooperate on vaccine development, because he wants to.
Well, just tell us what the guess would be. Is it the kissing Russian butt?
No, I think on the vaccine issue, he's going to really push the FDA and the CDC to skirt safety.
Yeah. Okay. But let's
get something out by November 1st.
Well, let's stick with the Russians for a moment. Do you have any possible explanation for his obsequiousness when it comes to Putin and the Russians?
Well, I think it goes to Trump's business relationships with Russia. And certainly your theory, Alan, may be very true that Putin has something on him. And that was certainly illustrated last week when the Putin opponent, I'm afraid I don't recall his name, was poisoned. And every world leader spoke out against that and calling for accountability, except for Trump. So there's definitely something going on there.
Unbelievable.
I would just jump in and say, except for Trump and Lukashenko from Belarus, who has now, I think, renewed his friendship with Putin. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's interesting. Do we want our alliances to seem to be with Lukashenko and Putin, who, you know, has made his intentions clear in Ukraine and in Belarus? And also, you know, there's stories out there that they are reinforcing the concept that mail-in voting in the U.S. is going to be corrupt. And they're also supporting Lukashenko after his election has been called into question. So I don't know. There's a lot of connected parts, and I have a tendency to maybe create paranoid outcomes. But it does the idea that we would walk away from NATO in this context makes me very nervous.
All right, we have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue and have our last go around on this Friday morning. We'll be right back after this.
Start remembering what you hear.
Well, hi out there, and welcome to.
And now, the world's foremost authority.
Check it out. Wearing the red striped shirt.
What do you do?
It's a highly specialized field.
Playing records.
Constant fun.
Are you ready? Let's motivate.
The DJ of the future is going to be a respected member of the community.
Motivate people to get out and buy or try or use.
I'm a long little doggie.
I want to get back to hosting the show, but I'm so intrigued by the music, I'm not sure. I don't really know where the opportune moment to break that up is. We're listening to Cut Chemist, and I don't really know more than that, but it's interesting.
Seems to fit the moment.
It does. You're absolutely right, Jim. It really does.
That should be the Trump campaign music.
Joe, yes. Can I just say one last thing about NATO before we move on?
Yes.
It occurred to me. So back to my time in Ukraine in 2014, the reason that those people from the Baltic states brought that up with me is that when the Cold War ended, Ukraine inherited some of the Soviet nuclear stockpile. And there was an agreement to give up that stockpile. And in return, the U.S., the U.K., Russia, and the Ukrainians agreed to say, okay, we'll give up the nuclear weapons in Ukraine. In return, Ukraine's territorial integrity will be respected. So then when it wasn't respected, when the Russians took back, depending on your position, Crimea, and informally invaded eastern Ukraine, nobody did anything. And the perception was the United States was not living up to their agreements. And that sends chills through the international system, and particularly to our fellow NATO members. Anyway, I just want to give that context.
Yes.
Because I think it's an important piece of the puzzle in the way the other people in the world perceive us.
Well, it is important context. Anybody else want to? One of the things that ties this story to our next story is looking at what is ahead if the president is to get a second term. And the while the president himself has often had difficulty answering that question as to what he would like from a second term, many people are talking about within the administration of how things are being set up. So now we move to the EPA and what they would like to do in the Environmental Protection Agency. So the EPA chief is criticizing Democratic governors and is vowing to concentrate on cleaning up vulnerable communities in a second Trump term. This is from the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, and he is arguing that the Trump administration, which has aggressively rolled back environmental regulations in recent years, has done more to help vulnerable communities deal with pollution than the misdirected and misused resources of its predecessor. Andrew Wheeler traveled to the Richard Nixon Presidential Library in California on Thursday to outline a vision for the future that emphasizes economic development instead of tackling climate change. Judith, have I set it up properly?
Sadly, you have, Joe. I mean, the idea of the EPA under the remember Scott Pruitt and now Andrew Wheeler, who's the head of the EPA and whose previous job was as a coal industry lobbyist. I'm not making that up. The idea that Wheeler is going to do better taking care of, quote, vulnerable communities just doesn't pass the laugh test. I mean, tell that to the residents of Saratoga Sites in Cohoes next to the Norlite Hazardous Waste Incinerator, where the EPA did finally announce an enforcement action there with very, very small fines and penalties for thousands of environmental law violations, and was silent on the central issue of the day, which is Norlite burning toxic firefighting foam with PFAS chemicals, which EPA did nothing about. In this interview, Wheeler pledged that the EPA would keep rolling back federal environmental and public health rules. The most bizarre part of his speech was where he criticized people in Congress and former EPA administration officials for just focusing on climate change. He said that this was an effort to virtue signal to foreign capitals over the interests of communities within their own country, referring to the Paris Climate Accord. So, you know, Andrew Wheeler and the Trump EPA, they're bad for people's health everywhere. We've got over 100 environmental regulations rolled back or delayed. And I think voters, both Republicans, Democrats, Independents, are not going to go for this. People want clean drinking water wherever they live. We saw in Massachusetts, I think one reason why Senator Markey won his race last week was because he made climate change and Green New Deal front and center of his campaign, which resulted in literally thousands of young people with the Sunrise Movement volunteering lots of hours to help get a climate champion elected. I think the polls have changed dramatically in the last year because people see California wildfires, they see more intense hurricanes, they want action on climate change. And I think Andrew Wheeler is just very out of touch. And also, last time I checked, Congress did not repeal the Clean Air Act or the Clean Water Act, yet the Trump EPA has dramatically reduced enforcement of our environmental statutes, which means dirtier air and PFAS in drinking water and other environmental threats, particularly climate change, that's going to be very, very hard to make up this lost time.
So, I mean, obviously, the whole point of this story is of what would happen in a second term, and so many, obviously, people concerned will try to keep that from happening, right? But is it odd? What should Democrats be doing at this time to fight that narrative?
I think they should circulate this article and say Andrew Wheeler, the head of the EPA, pledged that EPA would keep rolling back federal environmental and public health rules if President Trump is reelected. I think they should lead with that, and they should put climate change front and center and talk about how tackling climate change means creating jobs, which is something Biden has been very clear on lately. When he hears climate change, he thinks energy efficiency in buildings, upgrading mass transit, clean renewables like solar and wind. That is all labor intensive and has us relying on our indigenous energy resources, particularly in New York. We don't have coal in New York, thanks to Governor Cuomo. We don't have fracking. We don't have oil, but we do have the sun, and we have the wind, and we have water. Those are indigenous energy resources that can create jobs. So I think Democrats need to go straight at the jobs issue and just keep repeating Andrew Wheeler's pledge that if there's a second term, EPA is going to keep rolling back federal environmental and public health rules. I think it's, you know, unless you own a coal plant, unless you're manufacturing toxic chemicals, unless you're a plastic producer, I don't think you're comfortable with that priority.
Anybody have anything else on that? Okay.
I've been concerned for quite a while about the fact that progressives in this country, people from the semi-left or a little bit to the left, have, you know, not taken up the cause the way they should. And I take some real comfort from what we're being told here, that there's a sense that it may be turning around now, because if it doesn't turn around, we're goners. If not us, our children and their grandchildren. Mm.
Let us talk about one other story that is breaking today, and that is that on the jobless numbers, U.S. adding 1.4 million new jobs in August, showing a slow recovery. Sadly, Aaron not with us today, Aaron Pasitti, our in-house economist, but we talk about the story anyway without him. Employers continued to bring back furloughed workers in August, but at a slower pace than in the spring. Millions of U.S. workers remained out of a job as the unemployment rate fell to 8.4%. That from the numbers that were released this morning. Alan, yes, doing better, but still, it's a lot.
Yeah, it's incredible, and I pass.
I think employers are proceeding with caution. I mean, if you see what's happened with outbreaks in other parts of the country, there's concern about, you know, going back to fully staffed, because you don't know if the plug's going to get pulled at some point. So, you know, that's definitely concerning. And I think, by the way, I think the numbers in New York are significantly higher than that.
They are. Yeah. What are you hearing anecdotally from that, from the trenches, Heather?
I mean, we've had some good news this week that, you know, the casinos are going to be permitted to reopen, that there is a plan to get some of these things moving. But I will tell you that the vast majority of my members, if they're able to work remotely, work from home, they're on a path to continue to do that until it's clear that it's safe to return. So what that means for the related, related industries like restaurants, like the stores that are dependent on people traveling to and from work, that recovery is going to be long and slow.
Yeah.
And certainly it's very, very intense in the metropolitan New York City area, you know, concerns about mass transit and elevators and things like that.
So, yes.
So I think the recovery is going to be slow. I think it's probably going to, if we don't see another outbreak and we see some success with vaccines in the fall and spring, I think we will, you know, recover at some point, but I don't know that we're ever going to go back to no one working from home.
So Heather, how is the governor doing with your members? In other words, do they think he's being appropriate or too cautious or too progressive?
You know, so it depends on your industry, in part, but I think the general sense is that he has proceeded in a responsible way. There are certainly folks, I would say, generally more in upstate in areas that did not have the severity of the impact of the coronavirus and, you know, just didn't have the numbers that are still very skeptical and feel like, you know, there was an overreach. But I would say on balance, most of my members are very supportive of the approach that he has taken.
That's good.
Yeah.
Silence. Yeah.
We don't find a lot of happiness with our apologies. That's good. That's very good.
Well, I'm not going to say anyone is happy.
No.
But I think that, you know, there's a recognition that he early on adopted things like a mask order that initially people thought was too much, and now it's turned out, you know, well, you know, he was actually right about that. So, I think there's a begrudging respect in many quarters.
You know, there's this idea of the 2-year-old stomping his feet, Joe. You know, saying, I want. Look, everybody wants to go back to work. People can't stand for their businesses to be closed. People can't stand to be without income. So to make a concession by many of them that the governor's done the right thing here means that they're dealing with reality.
Mm. Well, and we still have to see, Heather, and I assume we only have about a minute, but the other big question mark here is going to be how the opening of school goes over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, I mean, I could talk for an hour about the impact that having children at home has on employees and employers, you know, the lengths to which employers are willing to go to accommodate so that they can have flex schedules, they can work from home if possible. But it's still, as long as we don't have schools fully open, it's still going to put a damper on a return to full employment in the state. And frankly, I think everywhere in the country. I mean, I'm in a household right now where I have a Oneonta freshman. So, believe me, we're very aware of, you know, what happens when the rules aren't followed. So,
okay. So a couple of things to, first of all, sorry about that. That stinks. Thanks to everybody. We are out of time. Alan, Roselle, have a very happy anniversary. Have a wonderful weekend. Celebrate.
We'll do.
Be
We're
happy.
Do that.
Excellent. Judith, Heather, Jim, I appreciate you being with us. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Be well. Coming up next, the Congressional Corner on WAMC.